welcome to our new Mick Artistic Seagull podcast. We'll be bringing you chat, insight, nonsense, laughter, music and a few surprises. And you can find out about our current activities, gigs, release news at mickartistic.com and on Facebook at Mick Artistic Seagull Trip, as well as plenty of footage on our YouTube channel. You can follow us on Twitter at Mick Artistic, at Johnny Ego Trip and at Ego Trip News. Welcome to episode 2. Today's guest is John Moss. He's a Premiership referee. He runs a record shop in Leeds called The Vinyl Whistle. He's been a teacher. He's taught James Milner, and he's also sent James Milner off recently. And in today's podcast, we'll be talking about the joy of football, vinyl, the smell of Bovril, the band Cud, our mutual friend Andy McVeigh, also known as the Burley Banksy, and his love of playing Plastic Fox to all his referee mates.
Is Jonathan Moss, or John Moss, or Johnny Moss? I'm not sure what you want, John. What do you?
John's got? Fine. John's fine.
Right. Yeah, fine. Okay, John. Well, I was chatting to a friend of mine this morning on the phone. I said, "Oh, I'm going to be interviewing a referee this afternoon, John Moss." And he says, "Oh, he taught my son, Owen Neary, at West."
Who was that? Yeah.
But you're a head teacher in Halifax, I believe. Was it?
Yeah, so yeah, I started teaching. I think the second job I started in Pudsey, teaching in Pudsey Primary School, and then I moved to Westbrook Lane in Horsforth, and then from there to Beeston, did a bit of work at Greenmount School in Beeston.
Oh, crikey! My God.
Yeah. So good place.
Yeah, I lived in 4 addresses in Beeston as a child. And I used to go to St. Anthony's School.
In Oh, lovely, yeah.
But I lived on Stratford Street and Hardy Street. And anyway, Beeston, yeah. It's an interesting area.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's really good, lovely kids. Really appreciate what you did. And then from there, went over to Moortown, but right on the sort of council estate, Firtree, the school right on the roundabout. It's just closed down now,
right?
And then got a couple of headships in Halifax, and yeah, and then obviously refereeing and stuff took over, and sort of do that now with the record shop.
Right, and how's the record shop going?
I mean, it's good, yeah.
Well, I think we had a chat, and you were saying that there's because of lockdown, it's people can't go into the record shop, so it's kind of online now.
Yeah, so obviously, you know yourself, one of the good things about record shops is going in, flicking through the records and buying something you didn't know you wanted. And I suppose that element's missing. And to me, it's not the same online looking for records. Yeah, it's all right to get a new release, but part of the excitement for me as a record collector is going into a shop, the smell of the shop, finding stuff that they hadn't seen for ages. And there's always stuff that you've got on your list, haven't you? There's always stuff that you've got on your list that you've had for years that every time you go into a record shop, you look for. And I think that element's missing. And it's a real pain in the backside for us having to put everything online for people to be able to access and stuff. And obviously, we've just moved into a much bigger shop across the road in Henley. And you know, we're geared up. We had a really, really good December, and then you think you're going somewhere, and then all of a sudden you're back to square one again. I suppose it's the same as gigging. You know, you build up momentum, and then you've got to find other ways to push things forward.
Yeah, there's obstacles in this life. I mean, the major obstacle being COVID at the moment, which is kind of stamping its mark on in everybody's life. You know, my brother just he's on a ventilator in St. James at the moment. He went in on Thursday, and we're all knocked for six because we've managed to get through life. You know, I'm the eldest of 7, and I've managed to get this far in my life without any kind of serious stuff happening in the family, with no major kind of. And suddenly my brother, who's gone from being a cheeky chappy, he's now on a ventilator, and we're all really, really worried, you know. But COVID is it really it's stamped its mark in so many ways, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's made me appreciate is how lucky we are, really. I suppose it's little things like music, like live music. I mean, obviously Glastonbury's gone today. I had my tickets for last year, which obviously went over to this year.
Yeah.
And then I've got my Bingley tickets, and I'm, you know, you sort of crave for that live music aspect as well, I suppose, for you as a performer.
Are you a man who does the festivals then?
Yeah, I've done all the festivals. I'm not as keen as I was on camping and stuff like that, and all the other stuff as I've got a bit older, if I'm honest. But yeah, I still love the festivals. I like all live music. I like to try and listen to different things as well. And I suppose having a record shop now, it's really opened my eyes to. I suppose I was having a. We went training this week for reffing and stuff, and I trained with this lad, and he comes into the record shop who. We're just talking about the vast array of music, and I said to him as we're jogging along, because I'm really boring like this, how many bands do you think there are in the world at this time? And you know, we probably know a tiny proportion of those bands, and you know, I try my best to get to know as many bands as possible, because that's the industry, but it's impossible.
Yeah.
And every day I hear about a different band, a new band, and it's just trying to find out about that, really.
Yeah, it's great. Well, the thing is, you're always turning over a stone and think, my God, who's this? And I just saw the Viagra Boys yesterday.
Yeah, fantastic. A Swedish punk band. Yeah, great.
I heard them. The amazing song called Jesus Christ, I Feel Alive. And there's this pot-bellied tattoo singer, and he's sort of Iggy Pop's kind of meets Shameless, meets, you know, Frank Gallagher. He's really... So that was like, but there's always something that distracts you from the mundane and from the horrible of, you know, this stuff and you know, your own worries and stuff. You know, you hit YouTube and then some nonsense, something wonderful, you know. And I mean, so you started out from Sunderland originally, weren't you?
Yeah, so my dad's from Consett, so steel mining was like the main industry there. My granddad and my dad worked down there for a while, and we then moved to Whitley Bay. So I'm a big Sunderland fan, mate. So obviously, we started living in Whitley Bay for my dad's work, and then sort of went to high school there, went to America for a bit, and ended up in Leeds at university. So that's how I ended up here. I loved Ted and Lee when we were a student, as you do. I liked the nightlife. I liked the gig scene in Leeds, and just sort of stayed here, really.
Where did you go then? When were you in Leeds then? What was that?
So I went to university in America for a year. In Connecticut, and then came back in 89 to 93.
Was the
time I was a student in Leeds. So the bands at that time were like the Pixies and sort of Stone Roses, but the big Leeds band for me who I absolutely loved was Cud. I don't think they got the attention they deserved.
Yeah,
but live, it was such a laugh going to Cud gigs, the atmosphere, jumping up and down, stage diving and all that. It was just brilliant. And, you know, it was just a right laugh going around the gig scene. Obviously, the Duchess of York at that time.
Yeah.
A great venue, the Irish Centre, you know, Faversham. There was a few gigs on there as well. You know, it was just a really good place to be a student. I always felt safe in Leeds. I lived in Hyde Park. Lived in Headley.
Hyde Park was safe, John. If you town wasn't so safe.
Hyde
Park was all right.
Yeah, it was good. It was just a good place to be. Good place. And then so I just decided to stay here, really. So my mates went back home and I quite liked Leeds, and so stayed here and got a teaching job at that point and sort of carried on the student lifestyle, but as a teacher, really.
So you were playing football as well, though, were you? Because I believe it's,
yeah, so
you were like you were up for like trials and stuff, and you did. Was it Sunderland and Millwall? You were doing trials.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I was as a schoolboy, I was signed for Sunderland. Then sixth form sort of was at Millwall, Huddersfield, Luton. Had a scholarship to play football in America. Came back to go to uni here. Went to Cambridge. Where I was at uni is on trials. Spent a little bit of time with Leeds, and then just played sort of semi pro football, Farsley Celtic and Yorkshire Amateurs.
Yeah.
To supplement beer money as a student and stuff like that, as you do. And then started playing in bands with Pants and people like that. Really, just
Are you a musical as well? Can you play an instrument?
I can play the guitar, but obviously not as well, and not as musical as yourself, Mick. But yeah, I used to play with Andy McVeigh in the band.
Yeah.
So we used to. Pants has had many bands. He's like he's the pop star that never made it. But we used to play in a band called Power Sleep. We're shocking. Like we just did a few gigs around Leeds and stuff. And it was good. It was a good laugh. A really good laugh. And we're back in. We're back in practicing. Actually, we're thinking about making the comeback after all these years.
Please do. You know,
no. You should be. You haven't heard this yet, mate.
I mean, life's too short. You just get on with it. Get them leather pants on and get
out. It was a leather vest. Actually, it was a full leather suit. Yeah.
I've just been reading about Susie Quattro and how when she first I saw her playing with her. I think it was. Possibly Thin Lizzy back in 1971, and she was supporting them. And this was before she became a pop star with Mick Chin and Chapman, whatever, Mickey Most.
Yeah.
But she was she came out in like denims and denim jacket, and she was like, you know, just this long haired bass playing woman. And she was good, you know, funky and stuff. And then the next thing, she was in this all in one kind of leather jumpsuit. And she was just talking about in the paper today in The Guardian, saying how she saw Barbarella, this film from the 60s with Jane Fonda.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jane Fonda had this figure-hugging leather. And she says,
and
when she put it on, she says, I became like Susie Quattro. And everybody's kind of went, whoa. And it's just like I got very suddenly, I was suddenly glamorous. leather.
Well, that's leather for you, isn't it? It's the future.
Yeah. Anyway, where am I? I was chatting to, do you know Vic Goddard? Have you heard of him?
No.
Subway Sect. Oh, never mind.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it doesn't matter. That's it. We'll strike that. But talking about Andy, I interviewed him. He's the very first interview that we're going to be putting out. I love him. I just love his enthusiasm for life and his generosity, you know, and he's just up for he's up for it, you know. I mean, we were playing. He was playing drums behind me in this school in Beeston.
I've seen it on YouTube. I've seen it. He showed me the clip of
it.
Yeah, he has a clip of it. Yeah.
He showed me. Never realised. But you know, he's kind of and we share we share this. Similar. I mean, I saw his work before I saw him. I saw these wonderful, bits of graffiti and stuff that are around, these bits of whatever they call it. But they're just so kind of, they're on the money. You know, they have a wit and they're very Leeds and they've got a charm to them and they're mischievous. And it's, you know, I just think they're cool. I think his work's cool, you know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've known Andy for 20-odd years now, 20, 30 years, and he's always been the same, you know. He's always been a cool guy. He's a lovely guy. He comes in the shop most days. He was in this afternoon, actually. He's always after a free coffee. I think the artwork, in terms of football culture and how Leeds were up until this season, you know, wanting to get back in the Premiership, I don't think anything represented Leeds more than Andy's artwork, really. And, you know, I actually, the first time I ever met Pants were a few of our mates were outside the Skyrack, and we had a gig the next day. It was me and this lad and this other lad that had formed this band. We had a gig at the Fenton. Yeah, so we practiced, but we didn't have a drummer. We had another mate who could hit a drum. That was it. He was rubbish. And we're standing outside the Skyrack, and one of my mates said, "Oh, there's Pants. He plays drums." So I shout across to Pants, across the road, heading the Otley Road. I said, "Pants." He looks round, you know, that look he's got. So come here a sec. So we've got a gig tomorrow at the Fenton. Fancy playing? He went, "Well, I don't know any of the songs." I said, "Ah, don't worry about that." So I'll start playing a guitar. You just join in behind. So we literally the next night, he played a gig for us, you know, without knowing any of the songs. We did all right. We managed to get through.
Oh.
And then the next week, we managed to get a gig at, remember a band called CD Basai? They were like an indie band. They're quite big. And they were playing this record shop, and my mate owned the record shop. So he got us on as a support act.
Right.
So it was like packed in there. It was like, and we played our second gig with Pants.
Why is it called Pants?
I don't know the story about it. I'm scared to ask that. I think it's something to do with his underpants and PE, wasn't it? I think it was something like that.
Right. Well, I'll leave it there. We'll leave it there. So, what possessed you to become a referee then? Footballers are—they're not glamorous figures, are they? Particularly,
no.
I mean, if you're a footballer, footballers are quite. There's something going for them, you know. If you're in a team, it's like, wow, I'm in a football team, and there's a certain kind of kudos to being a footballer. But a referee, it's like you're on a hiding to nothing, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, if someone had told me sort of when I was playing football that I'd end up being a referee, I would have just laughed at them. You know, I was the furthest thing away from a referee you could ever get, really. And I think it started by just refereeing kids' games after school. You know, we did the school football team, and you know, I used to referee at Westbrook and in Beeston, and then I sort of got sent off playing football for Yorkshire Amateurs. I walked into the bar afterwards trying to get the referee not to send in this report so I wouldn't get banned. I wouldn't have to pay a fine. And he said, if you could think you could do any better, just have a go yourself. And so I thought about it. I thought, yeah, I may as well give it a go. And I started refereeing like Sunday mornings, Ford Green and stuff like that in Chapel Town. And I quite liked it. I enjoyed it. It was something different. And then I wasn't too bad at it. I knew most of the players that were playing because I played against them Sunday morning and Saturday afternoons. And they sort of appreciated someone who played a little bit. And then I ended up getting promoted. And then you get onto like proper football with assistant referees, linesmen, whatever you want to call them. And then the next thing I know, I'm on the Football League. And then a few years later, I'm on the Premier League. And I didn't start out to be a Premier League referee. I just started out doing Sunday mornings, really. But I suppose a bit like yourself, you start off doing little gigs, and then before you know it, you're playing at Glastonbury, aren't you?
You start with a pocket of straws.
Yeah, exactly.
and people say, what's a pocket of straws? I says, well, I don't know. It's just a pocket of straws.
Yeah.
But I just stuck with it, you know. And people say, why do you take a fucking dipstick on, you know? because I like it, and and it's, you know, these are just the things that sort of they float your boat, and because I didn't feel I had a lot going for me, but there were certain things that were like anchors to me, you know. And if I found something like a dipstick or a whatever, or a crook or a buyer or something, there were certain things that called me and just gave me some kind of calmness. And it made sense to me.
And
it took a while to translate that. It was my own language. And a lot of people said, I don't understand what you're on about. But they hung on and they took language classes and they came around to my way of thinking. So, yeah. It's funny how you find yourself, because I found myself on stage and I never expected to be on stage. I'd just been divorced and And I was heckling a band down at the Grove. There's a band on, and they were playing Honky Tonk Women. And they were being really kind of quite complacent and quite arrogant. And I'm thinking, I thought, just play your own song. You know, stop kind of riding on somebody else's kind of shit. So I started to sing Pretty Flamingo by Manfred Mann. And then the crowd started to join in with me then. And everybody was singing, and the band were on stage, and then the lead singer said, all right, will you get up and do something if you're so good? And I didn't know what to do, so that was my... And I just got up and stood there, and I started to talk, and I just talked about smoking and playing pinball. And that was my introduction into... I walked through the door, and the next thing, I'm performing. And I didn't know what I was doing, but... It kind of, I found my little badge that said, you know, artist.
Yeah.
Probably it's like similar to you, John, that you it registered, you know, you were playing football. And you start, and then you're thinking, this feels all right. And you don't have any grand plans. It's not about having grand, it's just a case of like amusing yourself and making yourself happy. Like Andy, when he started doing these little boards and stuff, it was just to keep him happy. And he never was thinking about getting on Adidas commercials and stuff, you know.
No, I don't think there's anyone further away from being like a businessman than Pants, because, you know, he did it because that's what he wanted to do. And, you know, if you ever see Pants play the drums, I mean, when he loses himself playing the drums as well, I mean, he's a fantastic drummer. He's an all-round great bloke, isn't he? And I think he deserves everything he's achieving now and the notoriety he's getting. And, you know, and he's worked hard to get that. And he's, you know, he spends hours out in the cold doing stuff for the community, really. So to make Kirkstall, Leeds, the whole place a better place, isn't it? It cheers you up when you see those boards.
Yeah, because I was walking down Kirkstall Road opposite Asda. There's like the you go on sort of past the Cardigan Arms, and you're going on, and there's like the shopping estate. There's Asda and Greggs, and the road. There's a school there, and there's all these images on the wall that.
Yeah, I saw that.
The orals, and they're stunning because they're not particularly sort of kiddie like. There's some of them that are quite sort of, the images are like quite strange and quite surreal, and they're not kind of lovey-dovey, rainbowy sort of sentimental nonsense. They're some really striking images about being lonely and about being lost, or struggling to from another country or something. But some really strong and lovely drawings, and he's a catalyst. You know, he's a good channel for stuff like that. You know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, school kids are so honest. You know, they don't, this, and that sort of comes across in that mural, as you rightly said, that, you know, they just share the feelings. They don't think about what the wider picture is, that is what the mural represents on that wall. And, you know, there'll be children. Yeah, go on.
I'm going to say he allowed them to sort of, bring the vision to you know, out there, you know, and he wasn't kind of saying, oh yeah, I think we should do something about, he just let them express themselves, and now the work is there, sort of, to, you know, 3 foot by 3 foot across the wall. You know, it must be wonderful to be like 7 or 8 year old and seeing your image,
yeah, definitely,
you know, there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a credit to Mr. McVeigh, you know, that So, when you finish the match, I mean, it must be strange now, because like you're out there running around, and there's all these whatever with these lads, and there's no noise. There's just whatever 30, 40 people there in that space, as opposed to 50, 60,000 people and whatever. So what does that feel? How does that compare to, like, you know, like 2 years ago, you know, to 18 months?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a different world now, aren't we? We're, you know, we are used to being part of the theatre of a Premier League match, and that generally entails a passionate crowd. If you think about Elland Road when it's full, you know, a lot of atmosphere, the smell of Bovril, the commotion as you come out, the cheer that goes up from the home spectators for their own team. And then you're refereeing 90 minutes of football with the roller coaster of a Premier League fast match, with the crowd joining into that and being part of that. Because that's why English football is so good. It's because the crowd are passionate, a bit like Germany. The grounds are always full. There's always a great atmosphere. And so obviously the players thrive on that. We as referees thrive on that as well.
Have you refereed abroad, or have you been
over? Yeah, been all over the world officiating. So, you know, most countries really, you know, far afield is China, and, you know, been to Hong Kong.
So what's
Kazakhstan.
What's the Chinese football crowd like then? Is it?
Yeah, it's just like any other crowd. It's passionate about that team. If you go and watch, I don't know, HT Sports and the Leeds combination, you will get a passionate group of people that care deeply about that team that come to watch. Yeah. There might only be 20 of them, but, you know, then just multiply that and that passion, you know, there's 30, 40 fold, you know what I mean? You've got, wherever you go in the world, there's a universal language of football. And what's good about the Premier League is that people tend to want to watch English football. You know, I think the last stats were that the Premier League is something like 220 countries around the world. A global audience of something like 7 billion people watch on average a Premier League game over the weekend. Obviously, we now miss the crowd, don't we? We miss the crowd. I mean, I've got a massive fan club in Japan. I was going to say I'm big in Japan, but that would have been a really cheesy joke.
Right.
Can have that one.
Crikey.
But I mean, but now without the crowd, it's different. It's different for the players. It's different for us as referees. We hear everything now that players say, and when they get tackled, we hear every noise they make when they get tackled, which is, it's then difficult to decide what's foul and what's not. And to be honest with you, when I first started refereeing again after the first lockdown, Project Restart, it was called, it was difficult to adjust to that, you know, and it took a little bit of time.
Yeah, because it's different. It's almost like a different. You have to almost like a relearn or something, because it's a different theatre now, a different stage, because it's all about just these 11 aside. And it's really intense and focused. All the noise is coming from this small little kind of square that you're, this oblong you're on, and it's people who are trying to sort of distract you or presumably influence you. You know, say I disagree with what you've done there, referee. Please look at this again, or just kind of the overreaction, or just. Yeah, I mean, it's very strange. It's like watching a bad soap sometimes. You know, hearing some of these groans and screams, and you're thinking, "Don't do me a favor," you know, because it's like this is what we're used to, and these players, that's the way they carry on, and now that the crowd have gone, they're still carrying on the way they would do if there was a massive crowd there. So, you know, making sure that the crowd can hear them, you know, so. So it must be. So do you go home after the match and just jump in your car, or is it like being a priest or some way? You're not actually supposed to keep a sort of a distance from yourself and the your job, and so you're not influenced.
It's all changed now. So in the past would be at a hotel the night before, and you would then get, you know, all four officials who are involved on the match would then meet 4 hours before. We'd probably meet the night before for a meal or whatever. But then you'd meet 4 hours before the game. You'd have a little meeting room to chat about the match. Someone would then come and pick us up, take us into the ground, and then we'd be taken back out to the hotel afterwards, and then you would go home. So at the moment, it's very different because there's no crowd about. We have to drive ourselves, which is no hardship. I didn't want that to sound like, but we now drive ourselves to the ground because it's safe to do so. And we tend to be out the ground a lot quicker. Can you imagine if it was like, I don't know, Elland Road, a full house, the crowd won't disperse. We'd normally have someone coming in to do a debrief with us, tell us how we think we've done, how well the game's gone.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen now. That happens a bit like this on a Zoom call the day after. So it's a lot quicker process now. But it does mean you've got to drive on the day normally to a game, get out your car, go and do the game, get back in your car, drive home. So it's just...
It's like being a stand-up almost.
It's different now. But
tell us about the debriefing thing. So have you got somebody there who's like going to be picking your game apart or something after the match?
Yeah, so basically that happens anyway on Twitter. But we get assessed twice every game. So we have a technical performance. So someone will watch a video of the game. They'll go through every single decision you make and decide whether they agree with that decision or not. And you will get that. So I'd had a game last night. That's just arrived today, and that's for me to go over, and I can answer some of their questions. They pose some questions about the game. Right. And then we have an ex-footballer or an ex-manager or an ex-coach who will be in the stadium and will give an appraisal based on how he thinks you've interacted with the players, how you came across as a referee to a footballing expert, if you like. So we've got a technical refereeing analysis, but also a football analysis as well. So they, because it's important that we know how we come across to players. We don't want to be getting on players' nerves, but also they can then put the other side of things to us. So there's two elements of it. And that happens on every game. And then you get a mark generated on a technical performance and a mark out of 100 based on your performance on some key markers that they've got.
So what happens if you're kind of regularly kind of underperforming or whatever, where your percentages are down? Do you get kicked out, or do you get demoted, or what? Or do you get put in the box for like 2 weeks or something?
But the stocks would be good sometimes, yeah. So basically, we have a merit list, so a league table, if you like. And if you, like in any job, if you're not performing to the expectations, then you would get some development points. You'd be put on a training program, and then if things don't improve, then there is the option for you to be demoted to the Championship, which would be the next level down. And there's also, because I think there has to be opportunities for the level below you to be also, because I think it's important that competition is important to make sure that you constantly perform, isn't it? Because it's important that you don't make a number of mistakes all the time, because that can't be good for you as a referee, and also it's not good for the game if you're making continuous errors. But you can also have a period of time where you're rested, just like a player would be if they're out of form. So let's say Bamford wasn't scoring for Leeds for a number of games, he might get rested to take him out of that.
So you
just refresh.
So are you working sort of right the way through this? Will you be kind of doing a match right the way through every sort of football season? Will you be there like every Saturday, every Monday, whatever, once a week? Refereeing a match, or will there be periods where you have like a half term or a
bit of a break? No, not really, because the season started later because of COVID. It still has to finish at the same time because it's the European Championship. So in effect, what it's done is concertinaed all the games together. So there's very little time for the players to have any rest, but also when the players are performing, obviously they need a referee to do that. So to give you an idea of the last week, so on Tuesday night, we have three roles. We referee, we're fourth official, and we're also VAR. So for this last week, so Tuesday I was at Leicester, fourth official.
Fourth official is, John.
So fourth official is so essentially on every game, there's six officials. There's four people at the ground, two Premier League referees, yeah, and two assistant referees who are specialists. So I'll never run the line unless someone was injured and there was no one else to take that place. And then there's a VAR and an assistant VAR who tends to be an assistant referee or a linesman, whatever you want to call them. So as a fourth official, you're there to help the on-field referee make decisions.
So will you be radio?
Yeah, we're all mic'd up. Okay. So when the ball's near the technical areas, you might help the referee with a foul and you also answer all the questions for the managers, because I can hear what the referee's saying to the players. I can maybe give them some background on why that decision's been made. The managers might not necessarily agree with that, but at least I can give an honest explanation of why the referee's given that, what he's seen.
Are you down there on the touchline beside the manager?
Yeah, so I'm right beside the manager. Yeah. I'm in between both technical areas. Yeah.
Okay.
So on Tuesday I was at Leicester. Last night I refereed at Manchester City. So today I've had a couple of debriefs. So that's taken up part of the day. I'll be training tomorrow, Friday. Saturday, I'd normally have a game, but it's Sunday. So I'm in Manchester again on Sunday as fourth official. Monday, I'm in Wickham for the FA Cup. Wickham are playing Tottenham. So I've got to go to London and then come back sort of early hours of Tuesday morning, rest Wednesday, bit recovery. Thursday, I'm VAR. So at the moment, there is Premier League games, FA Cup games nearly every night. Just to give you an idea, in January, I think there was four nights of January without a game on TV. So that's a lot. So it's a lot of travelling.
Yeah. How do you manage to keep an interest in vinyl, in the vinyl whistle?
Yeah. I mean, travelling for me is great because it gives me an opportunity to listen to loads of music in the car and then decide, you know, I've been in the shop today. Even though we're closed, we've been in looking at what records we want to buy, what new releases we want for, you know, a couple of months' time. Mm-hmm. We've also just taken on a guy, John Earls, who writes for Record Collector and The Enemy. He's a big advocate of his sort of indie music. We've just taken him on to write for the website. We want the record shop to be a bit of a hub. So we've just, in the new shop, we've built a stage so that we can put on local acts and more established acts. So we can do in-store. I know you performed at the other shop, which was really small. But now we've expanded so that we can get more in-stores. But also we want to support up-and-coming bands. You know, it's just where they can play maybe a few. We're very busy on a Saturday. So it'd be great for them to have an audience to play in front of. So we want to be the website and the shop to be like a hub where people could come have a drink, a beer, whatever, and also listen to some music. Obviously, we were doing open decks night before lockdown where people could come and have a go at DJing. And we want it to be somewhere where people can feel comfortable. You know, we have a lot of people with mental health issues in Headingley who come and just chat to us. Not necessarily about music, Mick, to be honest with you, just, you know, to come and we have listened to the problems. It's just, you know, because Headingley is a really diverse place. So it's important that, you know, we've got a lot of homeless people in Headingley. There's a homeless community in there. So it's making sure that they've got something to eat and a warm, even if it's just for half an hour, and maybe getting them into the library so they can access some housing as well. So I think, first and foremost, we're a record shop and we have a passion for music, but we also want to be part of that community. That's why we put our shop in Headingley, because, you know, we like the area. We wanted to make a difference.
You said you liked, you know, Hyde Park and Leeds, and it's And as a kid, when I was 15 or 16, living in Beeston, I dreamed of living in Hyde Park, because I'd be like, that was like back in 1971 and at the height of progressive rock and everything. And there was all these, lots of wild and drug-filled girls and boys who seemed to be having a whale of a time, and Hyde Park seemed to be there. There was lots of gigs being advertised at the university, and I'm thinking, oh, if I could just live in Hyde Park, it'd be like paradise. And I ended up living there for about 6 months. It was awful. From the Queen's Road opposite the Brudenell in this flat, I was having a bad time in my head. But I managed to get out, and my brother dragged me out and stuck me in a little house in Meanwood Road. That was an improvement. The record shop can be like a lighthouse for a lot of people. I know I go down to a shop in Leeds called Relics down at
it's a great record shop. Yeah.
And I chat with one of the lads I used to go to school with when I was Thomas Aquinas back in Tongue Lane in Meanwood. And he was the year below me, but I go into his shop and we just talk about family and stuff, and it's my world revolves around music and art, and I am completely, I'm drowning in it. I'm absolutely drowning in music. It's I float on tunes, and I'm listening to Mercury Rev tonight. I don't know if you're familiar with them anyway, but an album called
Deserter Song and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen them live a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I've not played the album. I think I played it once about 2 years ago, but I just stuck it on, and I was doing the cleaning, doing the vacuum, getting the house ready. And it was very good. You know, I mean, it has strange qualities and that help you when you're cleaning, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Disengage. I mean, to me, I've got a perfect job. I mean, obviously, you're performing, which is the next level. But, you know, I get told off family sometimes for spending so much time in the record shop. But it just doesn't feel like work, if you know what I mean. I go in, I put whatever records I want on. People bring records in for me to buy. And, you know, I'm an avid record collector myself. So I'm like a kid in a sweet shop. You know,
people are
bringing records in all the time.
Yeah, you're lucky.
Yeah, that
would be my job when I was a kid, working in a record shop. You know, working at Virgin in Leeds. Or I used to get a bus from Beeston all the way up to. There was a shop called Project just opposite the Ford Green, and I'd come all the way from Beeston to up to Roundy to this shop, and it was secondhand records. And I do remember to this day going in and buying an album by Johnny Winter. And it was an LP, but it was three sides of music. It was like a double album, but it only had three sides. And one side was blank, and it had one, two, three. And it was this strange and wonderful album. And it was one of this, yeah, there's a lot of record. A lot of times you buy records when I went back, and I'd buy them, and they were crap. I'd bring them home, and you get one decent track, and then you get six. I think, oh God! But I was always prepared to sort of take the risk, because I loved music and I loved reading about music and listening to John Peel on the radio at night, and it was such a kind of source of comfort and joy, you know, to myself as well as football. I love football. You know, I'd be out playing in Crosswalks Park, but you know, in Beeston, and with, you know, 50 of us playing football. You know,
yeah, it's a good little venue.
25 aside, you know, all that, some sort of 6, you know, 10-year-old to like 18, you know, charging backwards and forwards, like this wave team. And I loved it. I mean, I loved playing, and but I say when I got to 17, I had this mad affair with music. It was just a transition. I just thought football's for kids. There was something about, I wasn't going to get in a football team. So I just, there was just something about the sex and drugs and rock and roll of music
that was, nothing wrong with that.
That was glamorous, you know, that kind of appealed, that called to me, you know.
Yeah. It's probably, you know, I, it's much, It's much cooler to be a rock star anyway.
I don't, well, it's just funny. Because I ended up, I did a degree in theology. I was going to be an RE teacher. Now, you're saying you never thought you'd be a referee. Well, I never expected that I'd be taking a degree in theology and to do, you know, RE and teaching in secondary schools. But I did. I did, you know, I taught at Matthew Murray and went to Garth.
Yeah.
I was teaching up at Cardinal Heenan and a few other places. And but I failed my final teaching practice. And I was busy drawing at night. I was out doing portraits on brown paper bags. That was my, I had two small children, and I was out wandering around the streets with a paper bag and a biro. And that made more sense to me, actually, than being a teacher. You know, there was something about I wanted to, I realized that I couldn't, I had to make a choice between a steady life of being a teacher, maybe moving up the departments and becoming, you know, or being out on the street with a brown paper bag. And it was very difficult because I had two small children. But I realized that for my own sanity, that I had to be an artist.
Yeah.
I didn't. I thought I'd die, you know, so, and I'm glad that I failed my teaching practice, but I'm still kind of doing bits. I still kind of go in and do little bits in schools and stuff. And it's like yourself. My teacher training taught me how to deal with kids and deal with people.
Yeah.
Learn how to not to, you know, to just cool the situation down and keep people stimulated.
Do you think that's where your sort of stage presence comes from? That sort of being comfortable talking to other people, like, you know, as a teacher, you would have stood up in front of a class on your teaching practice. Do you think that's where that confidence come that you have in the presence that you have?
Partially, but I think that prior to me actually doing my teacher training course, I went out on the streets with my paper bags and biros back in like 1982, and I had 4 years just wandering left, right, and centre, walking into offices, pubs, shops, and just asking people if they'd like their own personal paper bag. So that gave me an enormous kind of skin, kind of armour, because I had to sort of deal with derision and confusion, and I had to just be very kind of focused and strong, and without being kind of aggressive. I had to sell somebody that they needed a brown paper bag with a face on it. You know, some butcher on Armley Town Street, you know. Well, have you not got any proper paper? So there was I had to kind of make sense of my life. And so I think there was a certain amount of, I went through my baptism of fire years before I actually went on stage. And I'm also teaching actually honed certain skills I had, but I think that I did already have a capacity to live with a bunch of people around me, you know, to project or to, you know, so it's funny.
Yeah. It was interesting because obviously when you played in the shop, we had two different. We had another band playing on the same day, if you remember.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Two different genres of music, some similarities. The way that you both presented yourselves was very different. And then you had, as soon as you came on, and obviously we had our kids with us as well, you got up and you instantly had the crowd in sort of the palm of your hand. It's something that you can't, it was just like, obviously I've seen a lot of people talking, I've been to a lot of different things, and some people have got that natural ability to just draw you in, and it always fascinates me. And you instantly had that crowd within 30 seconds had bought into what you wanted to do. My two children were in front of me and never seen you perform before, bang, and they were like glued watching, like, you know. And it was just, it was, it was, it was only small, and I know it's your podcast, but it was just, I've never had a chance to say to you, it was just a brilliant 20 minutes.
It was lovely. Of, no, I can't.
It was just impromptu.
Yeah.
It was one of the highlights of the year for us in terms of you, you know, we had a lot of people performing the shop, but that, and the kids still go on about it. Mm. And as I said to you, I took Plastic Fox and I've taken it into many different changing rooms all around the country. So that song has been played. And if you go and ask any Premier League referee, they will be able to tell you about Plastic Fox. Many of them can also do the lyrics as well.
Well, listen, so, John, this has been lovely. I'm gonna kind of pull this to a close now because I've got to go and have some tea. But I always ask my guests on the show what they listen to at the moment. What could they recommend as a piece of music? It could be an album, or it could be a single, and it doesn't have to be sort of from your kind of like Desert Island Disc. It could be just something that kind of struck you maybe a week ago that you found yourself playing once or twice, and it's so what can you give me for the to pass on to the listeners as an album?
So yeah, well, I always struggle with questions like this. So I listen to there's a band called Shame. They had an album out last week. I think it's called Drunk Tank. It's got a guy with a bald head on the front of it. You see it in any record shop, or you want to get it online, whatever.
Yeah.
Brilliant album. You listen to it two or three times, and it sort of really takes control of you. And then today I listened to, in the shop, we listened to the Black Keys, Brothers, which is a brilliant album. I love that.
That's an old album, isn't it?
It's an old album. It's just got its 10th anniversary, so they've just reissued it. And then I listened to Supergrass as well, In It For The Money. That was a great album today. And look, if you get a chance, I think that everyone should go back and listen to Cud's first album, When In Rome Killed Me. Should turn off the lights and put on that top volume, Push and Shove. And that doesn't move you, I don't know what will.
I'm going to underline Cud, because I think Cud had the best name of the last century for a band.
Yeah.
I thought and I never got to see them because I was too busy being out drawing people on paper bags. But there was a few bands, another band called the Sid Presley Experience. And there was another band called, there's some wonderful names, some great band, Gay Bikers on Acid.
Oh, I like them, yeah. Do you know, you're a good lyricist, but Cud had a lyric, it was a band, a song called I've Had It With Blondes. And the lyric is, I was a teenage stamp collector. I lay on my back and you stamped on my face. Now, what a great lyric that is.
Thank you, John. Now, bless you. That was that was wonderful. Thank you very much. And I'm intrigued at the Turk Telecom football shirt behind you.
Yeah, that a referee.
You've got a collection of foreign shirts.
Yeah, so I've got a lot of shirts. This is, I think that was Porto versus, I think that might be Fenerbahce maybe, or Galatasaray. I refereed that game at Arsenal in the Emirates Cup. And then I've got a Valencia shirt when they play Man United. Yeah, so when we go away abroad, we tend to get shirts given off the teams.
All right, yeah.
In this country, we don't take anything at all from any games. But, yeah, we've got plenty of stuff going around.
Lovely. Right, John. Well, thank you very much. If you're in Leeds and you're on Otley Road, the Vinyl Whistle, stop by. Give us the website address of your shop.
It's www.thevinylwhistle.co.uk.
That's vinyl as in V-I-N-Y-L, whistle as in word play.
Yeah.
Thank you, John Moss, for coming on the Ego podcast, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. John Moss continues to terrorise football fans and managers and players on Match of the Day most weekends. And check out the Vinyl Whistle Record Shop in Leeds. For further details, go to the website www.thevinylwhistle.co.uk You can listen to this again and download this podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. See you on the road and on the waves next time. Bye.